Hello and welcome to Podcast for Emerge with me, Peter Bruce. It's a bit twee, I know, to label people national treasures, but in every useful way, my guest this week is indeed a national treasure. Wandile Sihlobo is an agricultural economist, chief economist at the Agricultural Business Chamber of South Africa, AgBiz, a popular and very productive author, newspaper, TV commentator, who also from his social media platform spills a daily torrent of really first-rate and interesting information and opinion in easily digestible nuggets. He's become really part of South Africa's daily social life in a way. And I've always said, Wandile, that we remain here a fundamentally mining and a farming economy. And while mining was well-run, farming kind of took a back seat, I suppose. But as mining has struggled, okay, at the moment, you know, metals prices are high, so everybody thinks it's fantastic again. But agriculture has become a real engine of survival and growth for South Africa. And thanks very much for joining me. And I want to talk to you first about foot and mouth disease. And very basically, please, because we all talk about foot and mouth and we know it happens to cows. But what is it exactly? Is it a virus? How does it spread? And what are the immediate sort of economic and health consequences of an outbreak?
Yeah. Firstly, thank you so very much. That was very kind of you. And I think on the foot and mouth, firstly, it happens. It is on cattle right now in South Africa, but it can happen to sheep, to goats, and how it spread. Yeah, it can happen in a whole range. And how it spreads is largely by movement of people or animals, because if you mix any of the cattle that are affected by foot and mouth with the others that are not affected, then, of course, it's a virus. It is in the air. It is in the movement of people, and it passes in that way. And I think many South Africans probably saw in some pictures or on social media that it gives these wounds like that you can see on the feet of the cattle, on the udders, if you are looking at the dairy, and even on the gums of some of the cattle. But there are others that do get the foot and mouth, but you won't see any visible signs of that. So you can almost think of it in a way, in the same way when we were affected by some of these COVID on a people aspect.
Yeah.
But with the one exception that it doesn't have the high death rate. For older animals, for example, it has a death rate of around 10%. But of course, for younger ones, it can go to 15 to 20%. But if you're part of that 10 or 15%, then you have a problem.
But so can you get over foot and mouth? If you're a cow and you get foot and mouth like any virus that you get, can it pass if you survive it?
Yeah, you can get over it if you survive it. After about 2 weeks or so, you can be able to survive and get over foot and mouth. So there are instances of animals where such happens.
And Wandile, is it dangerous? So let's assume that I'm a milk drinker or a meat eater. Is the meat or milk from an infected cow, is it dangerous? Is it a danger to me?
No, there's absolutely no risks to people at this stage, because you can still, in fact, slaughter the affected animals. But of course, you will cut off the feet that have as well as you cut off the head. But of course, then that means that profitability side in terms of the farmer, because you sell all of those meats in the informal market, you lose that. But there are no risks to people on the basis of this.
But there is an economic consequence, isn't there? I mean, you can't export meat from infected cows or milk, I presume. Is it likely that any of the meat or milk I'm buying in, you know, Checkers or Woolworths or Pick and Pay, that your sort of common high-end retail stores, is it likely to have possibly come from an infected cow?
That is highly unlikely, because although I say there are no risks to people if you slaughter an affected cow, but the regulations in South Africa discourages much of that. So from what we buy in stores, it's really what I would call clean animals in line with the discussion we're having of the foot and mouth disease. So yeah, there isn't much of that you find.
But
in the
we are. How's that it affected? Peter, Sorry, carry on.
That then, Peter, presents a huge challenge, because it speaks then to what you were saying on the economic impact to farmers. Because it's one thing to say we are exporting, but it's also then a different discussion to say in the local market, are you able to slaughter? Because now you're keeping animals for far longer than the period that you would have kept them on. To an extent then that now they get to be bigger and perhaps maybe even slightly fatter than the normal weight. And then that introduces a whole range of dynamics, given the specifications of the meat for various retailers and the clients that you serve. So it has a painful economic impact on farmers.
And are we able to export beef at the moment from South Africa?
At the moment, we are exporting to a very few countries in the Middle East, whereby the folks don't really have any animals. But also there is a clear, stringent protocol that we can be able to export to them. But I suspect that our exports for 2025 and indeed even 2026, that will fall significantly. The last time we were hit by this foot and mouth disease in 2022-23, I think our exports for red meat, they fell by roughly 20%, for wool about 19%. There were no issues on wool. But remember, 70% of our wool goes to China. And at the time, China was very nervous about any diseases, to an extent that they said, look, we know it's in cattle, but we're not even going to buy your wool for a particular period. So there were all of those risks and a decline in our exports.
So there's a big loss to the economy and presumably to the agricultural community as
well.
So the DA leader, or maybe not the DA leader for much longer, I see John Steenhuisen is going to make an important... We're recording this on Tuesday. He's going to make an important announcement, he says, on Wednesday. And people are speculating about whether he's going to be available or not for the leadership, renewed leadership of the party at their conference in April. But so he's come under heavy fire now. So he wants to inoculate or vaccinate the entire South African herd. Every cow in the country, John Steenhuisen, as agriculture minister, wants to vaccinate. I think the count is 12 million. Is that right? That's the number everybody seems to be using. People seem upset that they won't let him vaccinate their own cattle. And I just wonder what the arguments are. You know, John Steenhuisen wants it to be a central process, that the government controls this process, and he doesn't want a whole lot of sort of private people doing their own thing, and he's catching a lot of flack from pretty powerful farmers group. What is the argument there, Wandile?
So the thing about all of this is that, firstly, given the spread of a virus now, about 8 of South Africa's 9 provinces, they have it, with the exception of the Northern Cape. There's also a whole range of strains that are out there. Others are saying there's 3 different strains that we see. The only way to fully be out of this, because clearly at the start, we did not have controls in place to ensure that we can quarantine, we don't let it spread to the levels that we are in. The only way to get out of this is through the vaccination. Yeah. Ideally, if it was pre-2015, we had our own vaccine manufacturing capabilities at the OBP and the Agricultural Research Council. But as you, Peter, have written over the years very incisively about the dangers of state capture, the ARC and the others, they fell victims in part to that, to the extent that we can't now produce any vaccines. We're now depending on importing the vaccine from Botswana. And now if you want to vaccinate about 12 million head of cattle, and you're not going to do it once, you will vaccinate and then you need to boost and perhaps vaccinate 2 more times in the other years so that you are fully out of this, as Argentina and the others have done before, then you need to have that supply in place. The problem then that South Africa has is that we don't have the supply in place. Had we have the supply in place, it would then be reasonable to believe that every farmer grouping or agribusinesses and the others, they can work with the local structures to procure the vaccines from the state, and then there could be state vets to oversee while they are doing it by themselves. But the problem now South Africa sits with is that we don't have the vaccines, and then it has to be imported by the state. And in fact, that's what the regulations from the World Organization of Animal Health says. So when Minister Steenhuisen says it's only the government who will import, he's really following the rules. on doing that. You can't let everyone just import any vaccine, because there's also a risk of importing the wrong vaccine that doesn't deal with the strain that we have, and you can't really even know where what's vaccinated where. But where he can have a bit of flexibility is once the vaccines are in country, to allow others through a supervision to be able to do their vaccines in their regions, but under certain guidelines.
Yeah. Just get back to not having the vaccines. I mean, state capture ended in 2017, 2018. That's almost, you know, getting on for 10 years ago. Why are we unable? I mean, this is embarrassing. Why are we unable to produce a vaccine? This is a country, by the way, which is, you know, during COVID, we went on and on and on about, you know, not being supplied with vaccines by the Western world who were developing them. But we ourselves have not been able to keep up with even the most basic vaccines, which are presumably foot and mouth is hardly a new disease, let alone snake venom, anti-venom injections, which frequently we run out of. How bad is, I think the institute is Ondersteput, right? Is that that's where these things are produced. What's happened to Ondersteput? Does it function? Is it, what use is it? What use is it to us at the moment as an institution?
Peter, this is one of the great shames, because I mean, I'm one of the people who go out there and write about how South Africa is a leader in Africa in terms of agriculture. I gave a TED talk telling people to monitor what we do and try to emulate us. But now we are at this level. The key point is that, one, of course, the impact of the state capture stuff, they are far lasting. But it is also true that we did not move with speed to deal by putting these institutions in place. And I guess the reason for that was the fact that these diseases were not perhaps maybe occurring in large scale as in today. And we prioritized other things rather than making sure that we have our house in order. But I will say one thing on this now, to say, as much as we are in this great difficulty, the focus that has been put on the OBP and the Agricultural Research Council, it has placed them to in a place where they are telling us that perhaps maybe by March or April, they will be able to produce about 10, 20,000 doses and then increase and ramp it up. That speaks again to the point that you were saying, that we actually have the facility, we have the skills, but we just did not take care of all of these things that were in, and we let them run out. And of course, the financial mismanagement that has happened in some of these organizations. It is only now when we are building the plane while we need to actually having it flying and doing its work.
Have there been consequences in management terms, Wandile? Have people been removed from Ondersteput? Has it got good leadership in place? You know it well, I'm sure. I mean, can we get back this capacity, and can we now keep it? Or will it fall apart again?
I think now we do have a good management. And in fact, the Director General of the Department of Agriculture, Ndate Mokgweetsi Ramasodi, is one of the people that all of us in the industry respect him a lot. Okay. And at the ARC, Dr. Lita and many others. So there are individuals. But I think now the task is also on them to up then and make sure that they are scientific capabilities under their departments that are working to drive this progress, and understand also the urgency that is at hand here, because it does no good to not move with the necessary speed while the virus is spreading.
And when you let 12 million cattle, that's a really big number, right? And some I keep hearing numbers, I think from Johnson & Hayes and maybe elsewhere, 2 million vaccinations have already been done, right? So we're looking at vaccinating 10 million cows left. I understand big farms, big ranches would have, you know, large herds on them. But you know, because we're both from the Eastern Cape, that, you know, places like the Transkei, there are cows everywhere and they roam around and you know, young kids get to look after them during the day. You become a herd boy as part of your rite of passage in life, and it's an incredibly responsible job, actually, because that's your wealth that your parents are putting in your hands. But nonetheless, how do you get them all done? You know, can you be sure you've got everyone?
I mean, this is one of my greatest concerns in here, where I was saying, look, logistically, this is a difficult undertaking. And I would even say, Peter, from where you and I come from, we are even better because we have the rural provinces. And you will know that we have those old dipping tanks, and cows can still be moved to those dipping tanks. Yeah. You revive them as a central places. But think about someone who's in Mtanzane, Kwalanga, and all of these townships in KZN. What do you do in that case, whereby you don't know whose cattle is where, and what's vaccinated and what's not vaccinated?
Yeah.
And the other thing then, of course, is the fact that where people walk and the infected animals walk, and then they go walk in their own crawls, you have already passed the disease to them. So there's all of these controls that are really not in place, which is why sometimes think perhaps maybe people like Mr. Dean McPherson, the fencing that used to be done in certain areas so that you can separate the household with the grazing felt is something that, when the resources permit, still needs to be put in place.
Yeah.
But the logistics of running this are going to be tough. And the last thing I just want to say this on is that the cattle that are in commercial farmers are only about 7.2 million. Then the rest of it is in the communal areas. In
that's 5 million just walking around. You were very interesting. So about the dipping tanks, right? I remember clearly in the old days, right? Back in when I was growing up, there was always a guy who kept the book, the dipping book, and there was a register of cattle in his area, and you would dip it down, it would tick your thing, okay, your cow's being dipped. Does that happen any longer? I mean, is that all?
That's the problem, though, Peter, because that was the key thing that that's a key thing that we need right now. Because that guy, if you remember, there used to be vaccines that would be done whenever certain outbreak would come. And then he would keep the records of what's vaccinated. Yeah. He also keeps the records of how many cattle are there. Then you would know that for a certain area of Mganduli, I'm dispatching this much doses. Right now, you can't tell me that you know at every village how many doses you are actually going to deploy. Because you have no idea how many cattle are.
Yeah. Oh, man. So it's structurally something has fallen apart, and it's a serious thing. Does what markets?
Peter, I do want not to put only on government here. Traditional leaders and the community leaders, those people that you are referring to in Isthosa, we call them Unodipa.
Yeah.
They were coming from those communities. What are their traditional leaders and the others doing at this moment? Because those systems fell because they too don't seem to actually be paying attention.
Yeah. I know that in large parts of the Transkei, the dipping books were kept at the local trading store, which was another thing that fell apart, obviously, after the Transkei and those things became independent. Just in terms of what we're missing out on, if we get our herd healthy again, what sort of markets are open to us? How much money is available? You know, we all know that Brazil is the biggest beef exporter in the world, and that's possibly why the Amazon is slowly disappearing, because they keep clearing the Amazon so that cows have got somewhere to graze. But it's obviously a very lucrative export if you can get it right.
I mean, it is a lucrative market because already now we are new on the export market, but we're already earning just over $300 million on just exporting. I think we were just up above 30,000 tons or so of fresh and fresh beef and the frozen ones. Yeah. So it was already big. But the point is that we could push that and get into $1 billion and even more. And the beauty about animals is also when you deal with the South African structural problems of saying, okay, you want inclusion, you can only do the issues of transformation much faster through the livestock industry, because that's what people have, but also that's where some of the big feedlots like the Karan Beef, Cernic, Sparta, Beefmaster, they've all opened various stations across the country where they allow then communities to actually auction they are cattle. Now, what the losses that is caused by this one is because certain communities that know that each year maybe they auction about 3 cattle in there, they get income for the year. They are unable to make those sales this time around because, of course, people are not accepting the animals. but also then the exports aspect that you do lose in that. So that the impact is really in many layers. And I think that we are yet to fully comprehend the cost of all of this.
But do people understand, do people in Transkei or the townships who have cattle who they could normally trade, or do they understand why they're in this difficulty? Do they know about foot and mouth? Are people aware of it, or is it, you know, is it something that just pops up every now and again, and it's a disaster when it does, and nobody really does anything about it?
I think now the information is there. The Department of Agriculture has been able at least to communicate. But the challenge then, as you know, folks, when they know, they say, what to do about it then? Where is the vaccine? What can we do? And now you have to keep explaining to them then that, oh, no, we will have it. We have an application to SAPRA. Then once SAPRA approve, then we will go knock to Ndateko Dongwana to give us the money. Because you probably need, by the way, just for one roll of vaccination, you need over 2 billion rands.
Wow.
And then if you are going to vaccinate for 3 years or so to be able to finally get through this, you may say maybe 10 billion rands to clean up all of this virus. Maybe the numbers you may look at, or even more. Yeah. I'm just talking about now the vaccine, not the logistics of having the people that can actually do all of these things.
So John Steenhuisen's critics, and I don't know what support he has in the ministry and the Department of Agriculture, but the critics are arguing that it can't be done. 12 million is too much. He doesn't have the time. He doesn't have the expertise. But how is that? I mean, there's a lot of politics in there, I understand, right? So the people criticizing him tend to be Afrikaner groups who would also criticize the DA for whatever. And so everything gets mixed up in all this, but how feasible?
As everything is like that in our country.
Absolutely. But how feasible is vaccinating 12 million cattle probably 3 or 4 times?
I think we don't have another choice in here. But I think what we can do is starting off with the hotspots, which of course then the dairy, KZN, the Midlands and all of that, the southern part of the Eastern Cape into the southern part of Western Cape, and then move up to the central regions of South Africa. And thereafter request that the feedlots, they help us use their infrastructure to vaccinate the people around them as well as in their holding stations. For example, Karan Beef has a holding station as you drive up to Queenstown from the northern side, of utilizing stations like that and the others. Okay. And I think they will be open to that idea. But then doing this several times, of course, it will be a challenge. But I think for me, we have no choice but at least to vaccinate over half of our herd by mid-year or July or so, in order to have the industry. Because if we're not doing those things, we are likely going to have a major challenge on our hands. And we can't let this industry die. Because remember, Peter, for people who are listening us who don't watch this thing closely, about half of the South African farming economy is livestock and poultry. So if you have animal diseases, you literally are facing a challenge in about half of the South African farming economy.
And it's keeping a lot of people alive, and it's for an awful big portion of our population. It's your wealth. That's your family wealth.
Yes.
In those animals. Yeah. Let's just move on a little bit, Wandile, to many other things that you do. Land reform is a big one, right? So, and you've written about it. A Land of Two Agricultures, lovely. All these fantastic books that you've produced. How difficult is it to get land reform right? I mean, so when Cyril Ramaphosa appointed Steenhuisen agriculture minister, he split out the land reform thing. Probably, I don't know, was it because Steenhuisen was a white man and he wanted land reform to be given to a black guy, so he gave it to somebody from the PAC? Has anything happened? Did we make any progress ever on land reform? You've written about this a lot, and you still write about it constantly. It's very frustrating because I can't bear to see another article saying, well, white people basically own 98% of the land and blacks have got absolutely nothing, because it's just not true. But I don't know what is true. You know, what's an accurate description of land ownership here? Because there's a whole lot of land when we talk about who owns what, that isn't even in the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the splitting of the two departments, I can understand the rationale and the necessity that the president likely faced at that time. But the ideal path is always having those departments together. I was there when Minister Didiza was trying to merge those departments and put them together. And it took us a bit of time to ensure then that they can function. Because ultimately, although I agree with folks like Themba Kanyokaitobi and the others to say, let's not agriculturalize land reform too much. There's urban issues. And I think that point is well made. But agriculture, when we're thinking about it economically, it's still the fundamental part. Because in my frame of mind, when I think about land reform, I always say it must address two things. It's restorative justice and economic growth. If you are doing restorative justice at the expense of economic progress, then you might as well stop. Because ultimately, people want to see their lives getting better by whatever policy that you are putting forward. And I always say, let's try to balance that. What we have been good at, to an extent, is acquiring some land. But where the state has not been good at is actually distributing the land with title deeds to Black South Africans. Johan Kirsten and I have written a couple of pieces where we show with data that land reform is not at 8% where others say, but it is now over 25%. We are coming closer, in fact, to the 30% that the ANC had started in 1994 and now moved it to 2030. We are coming closer to that. But the core issue then, which goes to the heart of your question, is that some of the land, especially under land redistribution program, because our land reform is in three legs, it's redistribution, tenure, and restitution. On redistribution, which is where we should be making a lot of progress, the state has just not been passing on the land. I joke, and I hope he's not upset if he listens to this podcast, Minister Nyonso, I say he has applied strategic invisibility in terms of where he is and where the land is. Because right now, that department has actually not been very visible last year in terms of land reform. And they are sitting at 2.5 million hectares of land that they should be putting to South Africans. And let me make a quick point on that, Peter, to say, South Africans listening here, they may not appreciate how big 2.5 million hectares of land.
Well, I was going to ask you, just give us, what do we know, what can we recognize as 2.5 million hectares big?
In all of the grains, in all of the grains and oil seeds that we produce in this country, these big maize harvests and soybeans and everything we usually talk about, we plant all of those on 4.5 million hectares. So when you are talking about 2.5, you are almost talking about more than half of that that you can put into production. That is where then I think that a lot of economic improvement to Black farmers and certain communities could come about. And I think we've been holding that and not moving. And the painful thing on this, Peter, is where, again, like everything in South Africa, people see that the government has bought a certain piece of land. Then they see those government farms failing. And then they start saying, these guys that got that land cannot farm. But what they don't appreciate is that those guys that you see in that farm, they have no title deeds, no financial infrastructure to support them. They are held hostage in a sense that they can't go and do anything and put their risk there. They only have 3 years in that land. Of course, you're going to see land reform farms failing. But of course, we also have not been good in selecting who should benefit on what, even if they are going there for 3 years.
Fair enough.
And that's something that needs refinement.
These are points you've been making since as long as I've been reading you. I mean, this is not new stuff, right?
Yes.
Why do we never fix it? How hard can this be? You know,
this is where the urgency is needed. And I think, I mean, I've discussed these points with the leadership in the country, and I think that there's a clear alignment that there is a will. But I think where the problem is lied on is also within the department. You can only do a certain level at a ministerial or at a higher office, but there are certain things that the people that are in the ministry should be doing. And my sense is that there's been some obstruction here and there over time in actually seeing these programs being rolled out.
You know, you mentioned Themba Kanyokaitobi a moment ago, and let's not agriculturalize land reform. And I do understand that there is a non-agricultural bond between people and the land, and not everybody who has a piece of land needs to grow anything on it. And there's a, you know, that's a strong political presence in South Africa as well. How real is that in your mind? Okay, there's not everybody wants to be a farmer. In fact, I don't know anybody who wants to be a farmer. It's a terrible way to make a living, because you are at the, you know, you live at, you depend on a whole lot of things you can't control. But nonetheless, it's nice to have a piece of ground that you can call your own and possibly give to your children or build a house on or anything like that. That can't happen in tribal lands around Mkanduli or Elliotdale or wherever it may be. Where can it happen that it isn't happening? Or is this not something you follow?
No, I mean, look, if you look at where some of this land, even the one that we are talking about, is pretty much in all of the provinces. That one of the provinces that has least land in that 2.5 million hectares, as an example, is the Western Cape. But all of the other provinces, there's actually quite some sizable land. And to be clear, we are talking here about the land that was bought at a market price by the South African government from white farmers between 2006 up until now. Because I know there are people who say land is not being bought. This was bought actually in some instances that are higher than the market price.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the one that is in. And I think at this moment, until then the title deeds and the transfer happen, then this land cannot be passed down on generations. Mm. It really is a short-term lease for the person that is in that piece of land. But also we do have within it some few patches that are sitting in areas that are closer to the municipalities, where perhaps maybe development can happen, housing or factories and things like that. And I think we need to be looking on this. But Peter, there's a lot of young people also that are interested in the farming space. I usually see online a lot of them that are there, which is why even when we think about beneficiaries, we have to give greater consideration also to them.
Well, they've at least got the energy to, you know, to get up early and do the terrible work that's required to be done. Talk to me a little bit about, because you've been on social media a lot about rainfall in South Africa lately, and you're suggesting that we're having there's going to be a good harvest this year, a good season. And I was interested in what it is that we all know that South Africa is a big citrus producer. We're the second biggest citrus exporter in the world, which is a cool thing to be. Where else do we, and I know that, you know, there's been lots of talk about getting into the Chinese market for a couple of avocados and some nuts and cereals and all that, but where else in our farming are we potent and really powerful, where we could begin to, like with citrus, you know, make our presence felt in the world with more exports? Because we have to. And I think it's beginning to dawn on people now about South Africa. We've got to export more. We've got to sell more of what we make to other people. So we don't make machines, but we can make good vegetables and good fruit and get it out there. What are the other prospects other than citrus?
I think, Peter, we are good in about, we are exporting in about 36 agricultural commodities or so, where we are actually doing well and exporting. And if you think of any fruit, on average, we are exporting 70% of the fruit that we produce of any fruit.
There are
some where, like table grapes, we only consume 5% or less of what we produce. The rest has to go somewhere because we just can't absorb it in the South African market.
Okay.
Which is where then the dilemma with the political leadership is always, because if you say you want to expand agriculture in the former Transkei, KZN, and bring also the host of this new land in place, you cannot do that while you are not opening the export market. If you are expanding production without opening these new markets, you are playing a very dangerous game then, because now you're going to bring the profitability under pressure. On average, also in our products, we sell roughly 55% when you put everything else in the basket outside of the country, having ensured that we serve our national needs. Because I've seen other people saying, I talk too much about exports while there are people hungry in South Africa, which is true, but they forget that we first have to serve the domestic market. We have a clear sense of what's the South African demand of whatever product. And we always make sure that we balance that. But we do well in all of the commodities. There are only four commodities in food in general that we don't do well on, Peter. Is palm oil. and because it requires a lot of water and it also has environmental issues. It's rice, it's wheat, it's poultry. We import 20% of poultry, and it's whiskies. South Africans are spending about $500 million importing whiskey each year.
Yeah.
So those are the only things that we are importing on a food and a beverages basket in large volume. Everything else we really are exporting.
Talk about, you said wheat. Do you mean is wheat and maize as being the same thing? Or because you were talking about...
On wheat, in South Africa, we only produce really about half of what we consume. And remember, we used to produce a lot in the Free State and the other areas, but that was largely subsidized by the state. Then when we got to the open market in 1997, 98, and the deregulation, it quickly became clear that farmers can make money in other crops. Then they reduced planting there. We now have wheat, about half of it really produced in the Western Cape and then Northern Cape under irrigation, and parts of Limpopo and Free State, a few regions under irrigation. The half has to come from Canada, Australia, the United States, the Black Sea. So those are the countries.
Is that a bad thing? Because wheat is not indigenous to South Africa, is it? I mean,
it's not. It's not a bad thing, actually, because I will hear other people saying, no, let's do everything here. I'm like, no, we can do other things in that land better.
Yeah.
Then we have income, and then we'll just bring the wheat where we need. So there are those things. And in fact, we have actually been trying to protect the wheat that we have in the Western Cape. Because remember, I sit at ITAC, the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa. And I know you, Peter, usually take an issue with some of our decisions on a range of things.
Yeah.
But one of the stuff there that we have, I wanted to mention, is a wheat tariff. Because we try to ensure that we put this tariff, but sometimes it depends on which part of the equation you are in, because the farmers would want it to be as high as it wants. The consumers don't want it, so that the bread can be as cheaper as it wants. But you always have to find that balance of a consumer and a producer welfare. And I can assure you, Peter, the issues you have talked about in other things, in the wheat market, perhaps maybe they probably don't exist. There's a clear focus on that.
And sorry, lastly, Wandile, and thank you very much for your time. The situation that was very, very potent a couple of years ago with getting our produce out of the country because the ports weren't working properly, has that marginally at least improved? I mean, I know the conventional wisdom is that it's slowly improving, but can you measure an improvement? Is there more product moving out now because we are doing things better than it?
There is material improvement. And in fact, even in the first three quarters of last year, we were able to see a 10% improvement in value, around 8% in volume. I think that when the full year data we have finalized in revenue terms, we'll probably have crossed $14 billion in agricultural exports. And I think that in a volume also will be up probably 8-10% looking at what we've been able to do. So there is a material improvement, but there was one mistake in November, December, which is in the Western Cape. There were winds, but I think that also we would have, Transnet should have perhaps maybe made sure that there's a lot of staff that is in there to assist the farmers. But I think that in a planning side, there were weaknesses there. But quickly in January, they were improved.
I mean, if you're running the Port of Cape Town and you don't know about the wind, you've just not been paying attention. You know, it blows all the time in Cape Town. Very lastly, AGOA, does it matter whether or not we're in AGOA as far as our farmers are concerned?
I think to an extent we do need it. Because as you know, Peter, when we are out of AGOA, then there is that 3.6% most favored nation tariff, which then ultimately would add on top of a 30%, and then we'll be at 33%. So on the basis of everything as it is with those Liberation Day tariffs, it doesn't make that much of a difference. But if we assume that the Liberation Day tariff someday, they may be reduced or out, then AGOA always gives us a bit of a leeway vis-a-vis our competitors, either in Australia or in Chile and somewhere in South America. Because right now, Peter, and I know that we are closing this conversation because I'm even more worried about what other people are doing and what we as South Africa are not doing. Many countries are cutting trade deals every now and then. Narendra Modi has cut 4 trade deals since June last year, India.
Yeah.
And in all of that now, he has another one with the EU, what this is happening, as well as the Mercosur EU, is introducing new competition in the EU for us. Now, we will not only be looking at AGOA in the US and thinking that we are safe in the EU. We suddenly have Brazilian oranges all over the EU, while we have to be there and the Spanish has to be there. So there are all of these things. The only way then for South Africa to move well here is to ensure that we open as many export markets as we can. And the starting point will be untangling ourselves out of SACU, which is one of the things that is also holding us back, in addition to perhaps the capacity that is needed at the TIC and the others to ensure that they open these markets.
SACU is the South African Customs Union, but what way does that strangle us in terms of our exports to Europe or to Asia?
So SACU is constraining us in signing new deals. Because whenever we have to negotiate, as you know, we have to go along with all of the SACU members. They have to buy in onto this. But my sense interacting with them is that they don't have the same level of urgency as South Africa in some of these things. And now that we are part of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, the tariffs are already in there. We have to ask the question if maybe SACU is still valuable in that way. Perhaps they politically, the revenue that we share with these countries is a necessary thing to see how we keep that going. But SACU does need a revisit for us to be able to negotiate trade deals by ourselves and not always having to go and ask for permission from Botswana or Lesotho and the other countries.
That's a whole new train of thought, Wandile. Thank you very much for introducing it. We're gonna leave it then. Listen, it's always wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining me. I really, really appreciate all your knowledge and your wisdom and your time. Thank you for joining Podcast on the Edge. I'll be back next week. And until then, keep safe and look after yourselves. Bye-bye.